Thank you for joining us for this episode of Journey Now, produced by Journey Church in Brentwood, Tennessee. For more information on Journey Church and our gatherings, visit journeytn.com.
Welcome to the Journey Now podcast, and we are gathered around the round table this morning with the illustrious crew that we usually have. And this morning, I'm hosting. This is Kevin. And with me is Susie Lind.
Hi.
Mike Erie.
Good morning, muchachos.
Okay. And then Tim.
Yes.
And yes, and Tim.
The muchacho.
And Alyssa McNally.
Hello. Hello.
Just call me El Grande Guapo.
I don't know what that means.
Alyssa? Is that
the handsome large?
The big handsome, yeah.
Well, we're going to try some new things on the podcast and have a conversation around some of the points of the gathering, the conversation we have on Sunday, just to kind of continue that a little bit. And this Sunday, Mike Erie.
Mm.
Yes.
Which, if you haven't listened to it, and if you're not like a regular part of our live person journey community, it's a great message for really any church that's dealing with or wondering how to talk through issues of justice.
Right. Well, and I also wanted to say is that we are attempting, we as a church have talked a lot about our individual identity in Christ. And now we've launched into this series on how we also have a corporate identity in Christ. And with that, we've had a couple conversations around the gates of hell. And and this last Sunday, we had a discussion of how the church is justice. Not practicing justice, but is justice. And so that conversation prompted some other ideas and thoughts, and we wanted to further that conversation this morning a little bit, because I think it's crucial to understanding how the church moves forward in a world in which justice is elusive, and what role actually the church plays in this idea of, I'll say it, social justice. And with that in mind, I think also we will come at it from a bunch of different angles. The other part that Mike brought up in his conversation message on Sunday was that the gospel is an integral part of justice. And I wanted to ask Mike out of the gate, just real quick, when you see the gospel and justice, how are they intertwined in a quick 2-minute explanation of how they're intertwined?
Absolutely. It's one of the really sad things that the concept of justice has been hijacked by all sorts of other components so that it's almost a partisan sort of issue. Justice was, this is what God's been pursuing. Justice is...
we'll define it.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to.
Oh, well, gosh.
Wow.
That was not it. No, justice is to make right, to make whole, to restore shalom. And it is, it's the heart of God's sense. The first humans sought their own way. And
I really loved that idea of taking steps towards shalom. And because that can look different for anybody in whatever context they're serving in.
Yeah.
But it speaks to what Jesus did.
Right. We often have a sense of justice is getting your just desserts, right? Getting what you deserve in terms of punishment. And there are times it's used that way. But it's more often conceived of as the state of affairs where people have taken steps and done the hard work to ensure that everybody together is experiencing the flourishing of God's shalom. And so that can look like individual actions like reconciliation and forgiveness, but it also looks like corporate structures like the year of Jubilee or leaving parts of your field so that the poor can have food. It's both. And the very interesting piece of this is that in the New Testament, the word justice and the word righteousness are the same word. Righteousness to us sounds very individualized, like I get credit for Jesus's obedience. But that's not what the word is getting at. The word is getting at the corporate sense of justice. That when Paul says, literally in 2 Corinthians, that we have become the righteousness of God. That's the word for justice. So you could say we have become, he became sin so that we might become the justice of God. It's not a transfer. Mm-hmm. It's that we become, this we is the church, we become the justice of God. So we're the shalom making people that exist on the planet who, instead of fracturing along the normal cultural fault lines, we're the ones who pay attention to all of those dynamics and seek to repair them in the bringing of shalom. Mm.
Can you expand upon what you mean when you say shalom?
Oh, fantastic. Shalom is this beautiful picture that often is translated peace, but that isn't big enough. Peace for us is the absence of conflict. So, but for shalom, shalom is wholeness. Picture a Jenga puzzle or picture an automotive engine where every piece has a place. I know that's your metaphor for sure, Kevin. Every piece has its place and is functioning in harmony with all the other pieces towards an end. Mm-hmm. That interconnectedness, that interdependence,
mm-hmm. there you go.
All of that is a picture of shalom. Mm-hmm. And so sin can often be defined as the fracturing of shalom in any way, shape or form.
A bad spark plug.
Or a catalytic converter.
Right.
I don't know what that is, but I know it's
or you don't even put your gas cap on.
I think
on,
we're having one of those fixed today.
Ooh, a catalytic converter today?
Not fun.
Yeah.
Not fun.
Yeah, that's speaking of injustice.
Yes, cars in general.
Yeah.
So we find ourselves in a moment in time in America where social justice has risen again, kind of out of obvious misjustices that have happened.
But it's also become a political bad word.
Correct. And before we go there, yes, politically mm-hmm. it has been hijacked for partisan reasons on both sides. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to drift into the political side of it or the partisan side of it. I'd like to talk to this idea of how the church embodies, because you're describing we are, not as individuals.
That's right.
So we've got to pull it out of this arena of individuals and put it into a arena of us or we, because we embody, we are the church. And it's not that we do church. So I think this is the confusing part for a lot of us, is that we operate in the world of we do these things mm-hmm. rather than we embody or we are these things. And that's the point of the series mm-hmm. and the point mm-hmm. of having a discussion of what does it mean to embody justice.
What's the difference between we are and we do?
That's a good question. We can do things that look like justice, but we don't necessarily embody that in our wholeness. That's the difference. When people look at us, and I think this is where we come back to the table, where we come back to this idea that we can gather around a table together and we can have different opinions, we can come from different economic classes, we can come from different ethnicities, we can come from all these different things, and we sit at a table and we become one, even in our differences. And that in and of itself, and I think this is where Mike was trying to go on Sunday and did, is the idea that we then become justice. We become justice because we're sitting around a table with people that cross what would be ethnic divides or economic divides.
Can we get real practical? So like, could we just use an example for this conversation?
Sure. Do you have an idea?
Nope.
Well, examples like in the Old Testament would be
the widows, or not
totally. That yes, widows, orphans, foreigners. But even, hey, if you steal someone's sheep, you not only pay back that sheep, but you pay back four times. So you make. So we get this. We have this phrase in financial arenas called to make whole, right? To make whole means that someone has experienced a deficit and now no longer experiences that deficit. So you could use examples and examples in the New Testament were things that we talked about, like some widows were being ignored.
Right.
And other widows were being taken care of, but the widows that were ignored all spoke Greek. The widows that were being taken care of all spoke Hebrew.
That passage was crazy.
So that's a racial thing. And the church had to deal with it, right? Because the distribution of widows, I mean, Paul spends a lot of time talking about widows. Massive deal in the first century. So we can camp on a specific issue like that, or we could camp on, which is more systemic, right? That was an issue that there was something wrong with the way the church had been set up, and they had to address it by appointing 7 Greek speakers with Greek names to oversee to make sure those widows were taken care of.
But let's talk about the assumption that was underneath it. And I think that's where the assumption was that when people gathered in the name of Jesus, that all that stuff would fade away. Like the richness, my wealth versus somebody else's poverty would fade away. That's what the assumption was when the gathering of the believers happened in those houses.
Fade away in what sense?
Well, are you saying because they had everything in common, like at the beginning of the, when they talked about that?
Fade away is probably, what I mean by that is is Christ blurs those lines or takes away those lines of what would be a cultural elevation of somebody over somebody else. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So when we gathered and when we gather, all of that should blur or go away.
Or be relativized maybe. Because I don't know that Paul would say, hey, you're no longer a Jew or no longer a Gentile or no longer rich or poor. But it's that...
But it shouldn't matter.
It's not only that it should matter. It's that you have to actively practice siblingship. So in James, you who are rich need to boast in your low position. So that's just not pretending you're not rich. That's actually saying, I'm at a disadvantage. What the kingdom does to me is remind me that I'm not great and powerful and almighty
because I'm rich.
Correct.
Right.
Yes. So I don't know if that's blurred or I don't know the best word to describe that, but it also works with the poor, right? That the poor culturally is marginalized because or they're deserving of their economic status or whatever. But what the kingdom does is elevate them so that everyone is sitting around a table as siblings, not in power relations.
So are you describing justice there?
That's what that is. That is that process of reordering social relationships.
So yes. How does an individual enter into that to become we? Yeah, that's the conversation.
That's almost my question. Yeah.
Right. That's the conversation I think we need to have because I think we're describing it, but we often as Americans enter into it as individuals, not as a we. And part of that is to lay aside our rights. It's to lay aside not even our rights. Well, for some of us is our rights. For some of us, it's to lay down our I don't know what the right word is here. But if I enter into this relationship and I think I'm less than you, I have to lay that aside. I have to lay aside the fact that I believe that I'm less than you because I don't make more money or because I'm from a different ethnicity or whatever it is, and enter into this as an equal as well. Yeah. So there has to be this equalizing that takes place as individuals in order for the we to become justice.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to figure this out because we've been talking about this for a few weeks now, and I really love it. Michael.
I'm trying to get Alyssa to say whatever's on her brain because her face is doing all this.
Do you have something? Do you have a thought?
Please she does. No, thought. She has. No, she does.
I'm about to go a different direction, so go.
Go ahead. I don't have anything profound to say. I just am thinking...
We'll be the judge of
okay.
that.
I'm thinking through this idea of... my husband is Middle Eastern. His family is Assyrian.
Mm.
All the Middle Easterners in the family. And his family is very... collectivistic, obviously. So the way that they approach everything is in the collective. And so I've seen that in all of its glory and all of its pain because right. I'm now part of the family as someone who was raised in a very individualistic culture, was raised to make my own decisions and to do so independently.
Yeah.
And that was like, you know, the most good. And so entering into a a different culture, and Sean still operates subconsciously in that way. Yeah. It just provides an interesting way of viewing the church, I think, because I think that's a lot of what you're talking about is that's the right. way that that's his right. family operates is very similar. Like when we all come into this room and we are operating as the family unit, nothing else matters. Huh. It's just that we're family. And so it doesn't matter how successful or not successful you are. Like you just, you're a part of the family. And it all, like, it don't do anything to forsake the family. That is your highest good. That is the goal. And so if you do any, and so there's like, I just look at that and I'm like, that is great. And in its best, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it has its own drawbacks, for sure.
Well, in there's like people who can abuse that, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. there's like, yeah. no matter what, it, there starts to become, because of our humanity, there starts to become a, there's power, there's people who have power in a family unit. We'll just talk about that instead of the church, but... And then they start to use that power to dictate what it means to be a part of the family. And so they say, this is what it
including,
means.
Including but not limited to welcoming outsiders.
Exactly. Like myself. And so it's like, no, like in order to be a part of the family, this is what it means. And if you're not that, then you're not welcome here. And then it's like, whoa, I thought it just mattered that, that we're a part of the family. But it's like, in order to be a part of the family, there's still like a list of rules that are often unspoken, just known.
Yeah.
That in order to be here, in order to be in, quote unquote, the appearance of shalom, you have to be all of these things. And so that's why I kind of have this confused look on my face, because I'm like, I really appreciate individualism because it allows me... I come into Sean's family unit and I go like, yeah, that's really unhealthy. And I'm not going to participate in the fact that you're bullying that person, even though that everyone else in the family is going to go along with it because the person in charge said that this is what it means to be a part of the family. Well, I'm not a part of the family, so I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to allow my child to see you do that. And I'm going to correct it. Well, it's really disrupting anything. But I think that we can parallel that to the church. And so that's when it becomes tricky because there has, to me, it's hard for me in my American mindset to understand how to be an individualist and to have ideas and have my own personhood and think like, y'all are messing it up and I feel the need to say that. And I, it feels hard to be a part of the family unit when you all are representing something I can't get behind. So I just thought there were some interesting parallels there.
Yeah, nothing profound there. Nope, not at all. Great job.
And that's
Alyssa,
what Paul
you're
did.
You're so dumb. Good Lord, that is so
great.
As
dumb as they come.
No, that's so great. No more disclaimers from you about profound. That's so great. That's exactly right.
Coming from the guy wearing a Reebok t-shirt over here.
That was an affirmation.
It was.
Yes.
It
yes,
was.
Of the wholeness.
I'm not experiencing shalom right now. What's wrong with the Reebok?
Well, that's what Paul did when he came and talked to Cephas and Barnabas, right?
In Galatians, I mean,
he actually came in and called out the lack of justice that was happening.
Right. Yeah. You're not living in the truth of the gospel because you've stopped a corporate practice that embodied justice because now there are Jews coming and you're worried about what they're going to think. So exactly right. Exactly right. So you have these violations in the New Testament of the healthy collectivism that's supposed to be there. That's family oriented. Absolutely. But the patriarch is Jesus. It's never a person, a human person. Right.
Right.
So there all the, there's all this honor shame language about not disgracing the name of Jesus, and that's all you know taken straight from the playbook of first century households.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Point being, you're absolutely right, and Tim, you illustrated an example where Paul the individual speaks up to this individual injustice because he's leading others astray. Absolutely. So there's got to be room for that.
So how does the gospel then creep into this idea of justice?
Because, the gospel is justice.
Well, okay. How does then a a individualistic society who understands the gospel in terms of individual rather than we.
Yeah.
Start to see
come on
the gospel as more than this individualistic justice for me or righteousness for me, however you want to say it. But it's to make me right with God is to make it just, to make it right, to make it, and so to make the church, so then the gospel finds its way into this relational malaise of individuals.
Good word.
That are trying to figure out how to do justice as a group.
You can only do justice as a group, right? Right? Justice is not something you can do by yourself.
I think I know a bunch of Americans that would disagree with you.
Well, right. But take it up with Paul and Jesus, right? I mean, that, no, yes.
But, okay, so if we, if
justice is social, can't help it.
Yeah. But there's this, so the gospel finds its way into this how I know it is justice.
I know.
And I know that it is that, but how do you see the gospel as being the idea or the remedy or the actual carrying out of justice?
Oh, here comes something profound.
No, okay. Reebok. I think that there is a level of... I think my fear in these conversations is we can't just put the blanket statement out like, well, it's the gospel, Jesus, you know, justice has been served. It's like, well, all around us there's injustice. So what does it mean to say that the gospel is justice? Pastor.
Don't you dare. Oh, the backstory.
El pastor.
Oh. That's
isn't that a type of taco?
That's
El
pastor chicken. Mike, yes. Yeah, it's El Guape Grande or whatever it is. Grande.
Yes.
El Grande Guape.
I apologize to our Spanish speaking listeners. Come on. You have a beautiful language.
Yes,
the man wearing a Reebok shirt.
We are ruining it.
Should not be.
Please forgive.
That question goes to the table.
We repent.
It doesn't just go to Mike.
You're right.
Yeah.
It does go to the table. As the Middle Eastern woman, would you please help us?
Yeah. Which I think matters.
Yeah, Susie.
It always matters.
Could you repeat the question?
No,
because it got
one.
Buried in the... El Guape.
Malaise.
Reebok.
The relational malaise.
Pastor Mike.
The malaise.
We can't just... The answer to injustice can't be...
I'm like turkey on wheat with a side of malaise.
I'm talking.
Sorry.
The answer to injustice can't just be the gospel. That's a blanket statement that's unhelpful. So what should our response to injustice be?
The gospel.
Which is what?
Yeah, which is what? I think.
What does that mean? I'm not just going to go up to a kid who just got taken from their parents at the border and be like, let me tell you about Jesus. Because right now they are freaking out because they don't know where their parents
went. Why don't you clarify that first when you say that? Because you're the one who said that.
Don't listen. I just get to say things.
Yeah, I know. But
I am not held accountable.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why we're around the table together.
So the gospel's construed in the following, at least for me, in the following manner. I am an individual sinner. I am also an individual sin. I'm an individual sinner. God is just, so he must punish sin. Mm-hmm. And so in God's justice, he sets forward Jesus to take the penalty for my sin so that I engage in this cosmic transfer where I get Christ's righteousness. He gets my sin, and because of the cross, I now stand justified. What justified means in this accounting is that I am righteous before God. Yeah. And all of that is a very individualized story. The story the Bible tells isn't that story. The story the Bible tells is that human beings are fractured, and that God is in the process of renewing human beings back to their original vocation. And that vocation was image-bearing and promoting the flourishing of shalom creation-wide. And so that restoration happens as people in community. In other words, all of the promises and fulfillments are given in community, and that justice becomes the identifying marker of what the community is and does as their collective self. So I mean, it's exactly what we said with 2 Corinthians, right? He became sin so that we might become justice, God's public justice. So when we say the gospel is justice, the gospel is just God's move to put humanity right. And in that rightness, there is no separation between right with God and right with others. Right with God means right with others, right? That we've introduced this distinction between, it's horribly unbiblical, between loving God and loving neighbor as if they're two separate things. Right. When, in fact, of course, what Paul does, and if you want, you know, back to Alyssa, Alyssa had a great question earlier too, where you, like, just take Romans, take Ephesians, take Colossians, any of Paul's epistles, except the pastorals, those work a little differently. But what Paul will do is talk about what God has done, and then he will instantly go into the reordering of social relationships,
right,
and not separate them. There is no paragraph break. Mm-hmm. There is no, you know, verse distinction. It's like, it's just, this is what it means. So mm-hmm. in Romans, you've got 11 chapters of Paul arguing that Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians shouldn't judge each other. And then he just puts forward how they are then to relate together in this arena called justice. Mm-hmm. So the gospel, if it's the gospel, the real one, by necessity and inevitability, cannot help but reorder social relationships. Mm-hmm. So what does the gospel look like as it pertains to justice? It looks like reordering social relationships.
Right.
Well, what's that look like? Well, one thing it looks like is that the ethnic, economic, social, and class distinctions that represent fractures throughout our culture are warred against within the church. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether we are, you know, care for BLM as an organization or not, or whether or not we're, you know, fans of the term woke or CRT or not, there is a gospel imperative to pay attention to the dividing lines that are in our culture and to resist those actively through corporate practices mm-hmm. As we gather as the church.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Totally.
What are those corporate mm-hmm. practices?
Well, sitting at a common meal. The communion is the biggest one. Singing a corporate hymn body would be another mm-hmm. one. Prayer would be another one. Lament. Suffering with part of, when part of the body suffers, suffering with part of the body.
It's practicing the one another's. It's the bear one another's burdens. Totally. It's totally. Confess service. Our sins to one another. It's yep. serve
generosity
one another.
Towards,
it's, yep. it's those... It's,
those are all justice practices.
Yeah, because you're moving in and taking, you are acting on the gospel as though it were true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
No,
I don't know how else to say it. Yeah.
And I think forgive one another is an act of the gospel. The act of the gospel of understanding that you've been forgiven so much, why aren't you forgiving those around you? And just that practice alone,
totally
within the community that we call church, would bring justice yeah. as an act, but also embodied.
Right.
So that feels a little preachy, but forgiveness, forgive one another is
no. That's really practical. I okay. mean, if you just mm-hmm. look up in the internets the one another's. I mean, well, you just start looking up those lines, internet's. And that really is.
Yeah,
that is the those are the politics. Those are the laws of the actual kingdom of God.
That's right.
And living those out as, but what I'm trying to figure out is how do I do that as an individual? I mean, we're doing it as a collective, but
well, I don't think you. I think what we're trying really hard to do, which is almost impossible, is separate the individual from the whole.
Yeah, I'm having a
hard
time.
But I don't think you need to do that necessarily. You don't have to pick one or the other. It's recognizing that the individual is part of the whole.
Yes.
And that's what we like. Your example of family is a perfect example of. You know, we are a whole, but if I start as an individual acting out of my own individual desires and dreams and expectations, I could really mess this up for the whole.
Yep.
And so when we, you know, for me, this is really a classic formation issue. Like the thing that the underlying necessity in all of this is the very Christ-like attribute of humility. And so when you have an individual in a family that comes in and says, you're bullying this person, you're not treating this person right, I'm not going to be a part of that, that's the individual bringing their best to the whole for refining and restoring shalom within that whole. And what is required in that community is humility to receive mm-hmm. the correction and the rebuke and the encouragement, whatever because it is, because you're a part of the family. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see lacking right now in that's our culture. So, so when a black man comes in and says, hey, the church has actually been complicit in the racism that we are all feeling the tension of today. And the church says, no, 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 we've been forgiven because the gospel is the answer and it's an even playing field. The whole is not listening to the individual mm-hmm. and is not practicing humility to become right in the essence of shalom mm-hmm. as a whole. Mm-hmm. So the best definition I've ever heard for spiritual formation is becoming like Christ for the sake of others, being formed in the image of God for the sake of others. So as individual Christians, we've taken the becoming like Christ, I'm to be formed and I'm to become Christ-like, but we've dropped the for sake of totally. The others part
totally.
Of it.
Totally.
And so we're sitting here trying to figure out how do I become an individual or become a whole part of the whole instead of an individual, when really Paul said the body is made up of many parts. You know, one person's this part, one person's that part, right. but it's made up of a whole. So it's not either or, it's both and. And my individualism is for the sake of the whole.
So good,
when I
so
allow it to stop as at how it serves me and how I look and how I do it better and how good I am and how I'm saved and how my personal relationship with God is going and how my quiet times are consistent or not or whatever it is about me, but I don't have it in mind for the sake of the whole. And what does God called me to be a part of? What has he invited me into? How am I going to bring shalom to my church, my community, to the world, to the sphere of influence that God has given me? Then I've forsaken the gospel.
Come on. Oh, my goodness.
So,
wrap that up.
Susie!
Man. Yeah, put a bow
wow.
on it.
Wow.
Well stated.
For the win.
So great.
For the whole.
Yeah. And there was the dunk. Posterized.
Totally.
Well, thank you, Susie.
You're welcome.
That was a great way to put a bow on this conversation. If you've enjoyed our conversation, great. If you haven't, we want to hear from you. Please feel free to email us.
Or we
want to
hear from you if you enjoyed it, too.
Okay, we do. Either way. But we want this conversation to permeate our community, just to be able to have conversations around how the gospel and how our relationship with God mm-hmm. and our humility or lack thereof at times affects the whole. So we invite you into the conversation. Please email us. Please talk to us. And we are about to transition this podcast to an interview Susie's having, I believe. And so for the win. And enjoy that part of our
Thanks for listening to the Journey Now podcast. My name is Susie Lind, and I will be your host for the next segment of this podcast. If you enjoyed the conversation that we had around the roundtable, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email if you want, if you have any questions or other topics you'd like us to talk about. You can send that to journey@journeytn.com, and we will do our best to get back to you as soon as we can. My conversation today is with Laura Day. She has been a part of Journey for the past couple of years, and you can find her sitting either in the back row or in the media booth helping the media team on Sunday mornings. Laura was born with spina bifida, and today she talks to us about what it's like to be disabled in community and what she'd like us to know about her. So take a listen, and if you get a chance on a Sunday morning, go say hi to Laura. Thanks for joining us today. Hey, everybody. I am here with the fabulous Laura Day, who has become pretty quickly a very integral part of our community. You can find her every Sunday sitting either in the back near the sound booth or in the sound booth. Hey, Laura.
How's it going?
Oh, it's good. I'm so happy that you're here with us today. Well, we talked a little bit before I invited you to be on the podcast because as I've gotten to know you a little bit over the last year, you have become, or you are, very outspoken and have been an advocate for the disabled community, particularly within the church, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted people to get to know you and hear a bit about your story. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I am from upstate New York, Rochester area.
Mm-hmm.
I have two sisters. One is a twin. I grew up not from the city. having a twin, an older sister.
Did you go to college in Rochester too?
I have 3 degrees. Oh. I hate saying that because people are like, oh, why? You have three degrees.
That's a good flex.
I didn't even want to go to college, honestly. I basically had someone in high school basically hand me a college application and say, yeah, you should at least apply to this one. It was like the community college nearby, yeah, where like everyone gets in. They're like, you should at least, you know, apply.
So is that where you went, the first one?
So that was actually the first one I went to. It was Finger Lakes Community College. I originally started as a music recording.
Mm-hmm.
Decided that wasn't for me. Theory kind of killed it. And so I decided at that point, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I still knew that I wanted to do something with music or in the industry somehow. So I kind of went to my advisor and I was like, hey, what should I do from here? And they were like, well, you can kind of go a couple different options. And you can either do a communications degree or a business degree if you want to stay here. And so you kind of figure out what you want to do, like, in the music industry.
So what'd you decide?
So I decided on a communications degree.
Nice.
It was an associate's.
That's what my degree's into.
Really?
John, our producer, is nodding as well.
So I decided to do communications. I had only done like a couple semesters in the music recording program, mm-hmm, before I switched.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided to get the communications degree. And by that time, I think I ended up going to that college in total like 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit more than expected because it was supposed to be like a 2-year program.
Yeah.
And so I graduated with that communications degree and then decided, well, I still don't really know what I want to do. So I kind of took a year off. And then my cousin, she kind of is like me. Her name's Allie. She likes live events and concerts and conferences and music, mm-hmm, festivals and those kinds of things. And so she was actually interested in event management.
Mm-hmm.
That was my third degree. I'm getting them mixed up. But no, so my second degree, I decided I wanted to do something to help kids with disabilities or people with disabilities. So I decided after I took like a year off, I saw therapeutic recreation just Googling online, mm-hmm, one time, and I was like, hey, that really sounds like me. It's like you're playing, but you're also helping people. So I went to Cortland, SUNY Cortland, for a therapeutic recreation degree, and decided.
Was that a bachelor's?
That was a bachelor's.
Okay.
But by that time, I already had a lot of my gen eds done. So I came in as a junior, I think. And so I did a couple semesters in that program and decided I didn't like the clinical side of that. So here we are again. And I'm just like, okay, what do I do with my life? And so I was kind of at the point then where I was just done with school.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, I just want to get out of there. And like, I just want to be done with school. So I decided, okay, well, I don't want to just waste what I just like accomplished in the last, you know, few semesters or whatnot. So I decided I'm just going to do a straight recreation degree. So I basically just did that just to get out and say that I had a bachelor's degree. But I'm thankful for the experience though too, because that I feel like all of my degrees kind of, mm-hmm, kind of intertwined. So then after that degree, that was when my cousin, she was interested in event management. And so I was like, hey, that really sounds like me, like more than the therapeutic recreation. So it kind of felt like everything, like every step closer to a degree or whatnot, or completing a degree was like, okay, a little bit closer to what maybe I wanted to do with my life. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going to Niagara University with my cousin, both in the event management degree. It was the School of Hospitality and Tourism with a concentration in event management.
So basically you like to help people have fun.
Basically, yes. I am a professional in helping people have fun.
You're good at it. I mean, you really like ran the show at Journey Fest this summer. We had an outdoor music festival here at Journey. 5 or 6 different bands, mm-hmm. hundreds of people showed up, mm-hmm. food trucks, the whole like inflatables for kids, and mm-hmm.
I was a helper.
You were more than a helper. you were a helper.
I was a helper.
But you were like the queen of helpers.
Yes.
You were the queen of all helpers. I mean, it was pretty fantastic just to see you in your element. Now, so listeners cannot see us, but mm-hmm. you are sitting in a wheelchair currently. Yes. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us about that?
And related to Journey, because I kind of wanted to... Or Journey Fest, because I kind of wanted to stop there for a second.
Okay.
So Journey Fest, since we've already mentioned it, like that, I was actually sitting with a friend, Lindsay Buckles, actually, mm-hmm. One time we were just hanging out, and she mentioned that there was going to be this festival or whatnot that Journey was going to do. And she was like... she was telling me about what it was, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is like my dream, like to do some kind of like a live event, something. And she was like, well, why don't you ask Sam, who was kind of heading it all up, if you can help? And I'm like, I'm not the type of person to be just be like, hey, can I help with something? You know, like, because I struggle with rejection and failure. So those are always fears that kind of keep me from things. So I was like, I don't want to ask Sam, but I like knew that I really, really wanted to, but just that fear was holding me back. Mm. But Lindsay really just encouraged me to reach out to him. And so I did. And he, you know, he said yes without like blinking an eye pretty much. And for me, that was like huge, because I'm like, all this time I'm amping it up, like, oh, like I don't know what he's gonna say, or you know, I don't know if I'm gonna be accepted, or you know, if they're gonna want the help. But that was to me just like a invitation to just be myself, and an invitation to realize like, this is who God, like, this is the way God sees me, like, not as someone who is incapable, but someone who's capable. So that was huge.
Well, the whole time in the prep time, I mean, Sam would always say how huge of a help you've been.
Yeah.
And then to see you in action was really something to behold, you know? Because I mean, the reality is, I could see where you would feel that way because, mm-hmm. you know, you're small, but you're mighty. Yes. You know, I mean, you're a petite woman. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But
it also has to do with just like having a disability. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I never really realized it, but I grew up in a society, well, at the time, I didn't realize what became of it or why it was happening or like why subconsciously I was dealing with stuff. But I realized that like I live in a society where people with disabilities are like second class citizens, mm-hmm. And they're seen as incapable. You know, you see like someone in a wheelchair or something like that, or someone with an intellectual disability, and automatically you are kind of just like dismissed. Like you're just, people just think that you're incapable.
Is that the term ableism? Is that what that means?
Yeah, ableism is like when basically it's like people are like assumed that like able-bodied people are just like dominant. And mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have the best definition of ableism, but basically it's not thinking of the disabled community. Mm-hmm. and especially not thinking of us as equals.
So that wasn't something you had an awareness of when growing you were up, younger?
No, okay. No, I didn't have awareness of that, but I knew that I was living in a world where it was seen as different and not as, yeah. But I guess what became of it, like, because I grew up in, you know, society where disability is not seen as, you know, on the same playing field as, like, able-bodied, I grew up with a fear of rejection and failure, which led to my own, like, idea of, like, self-imposed limitations because of the fact that I was, subconsciously believed the, you know, the lie of, you know, I'm not capable and I'm not as good or whatnot. And it wasn't really self-aware of those things until really in the last few years, and especially having moved to Nashville. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really aware of the
fact. What was it that made you aware moving? Besides just the move.
The reality of experiencing everything new. Like, because of my fear of failure and rejection, I don't really try new things because of that fear. Like, I don't want to fail and I don't want to be rejected. And everything when I moved was new. Mm-hmm. I was in a new state. I was in a new city, a new church, I had a new roommate, like that wasn't my parents. Mm-hmm. And everything was new to me. And so I really had to face that fear. And like, that's really how I became aware of it, was the fact that I was faced with it. Like, I didn't have a choice, but everything was new. And that's just kind of how I became aware of those fears. Mm-hmm. And I realized that my fear wasn't even just in like outside of the church even. Like, I realized that it was just as a whole, like, I live in fear.
Yeah.
And especially like trying new things, you know, when I'm in a new state and whatnot. When I started on the tech team, I was so anxious. I mean, like, I always struggle with anxiety, but I realized, because every single time, like, I mean, even now, but not as much, but I would always be so anxious.
Do you feel like you have to prove yourself to be better than a person without a disability?
Yeah,
or that's a perceived disability, shall we say?
Yeah, that's, I mean, because we all have our, yeah, you know, limitations and whatnot, but that's exactly what, like, it was.
You have to prove yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it was. That's where the root of everything was. I felt like without even really being able to name it first, mm-hmm, I realized that I was living in this fear because I felt like I had to prove myself because of society's view.
Yeah. So then do people, how is it for you? Like, okay. So at my last church, there was a guy that was there who was in a wheelchair, mm-hmm, and he would get angry when people would try to help him, you know, and I don't experience you that way, mm-hmm, but how does it feel to you when people try to go out of their way to help you because, mm-hmm, they think you might need help? And you're not always, I mean, sometimes you're in your wheelchair, sometimes you're not. And I know, right, that relates to how you're doing that particular day. And it's, right, you know.
Yeah.
But what is that like for you?
I mean, that's a very loaded question.
Yes, we like those on this podcast.
That's a very, I mean, and everyone's different. Like, every, mm-hmm, person, like, in the disability community.
Yes, and has, you are not speaking for the whole, right, disabled, yes, community. We want to know Laura Day.
Yes, yes. So, for me, it depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. I have, and I have some friends that would kind of go on either side of that, where they would be like, oh, no, I don't care. Like, I love the help and whatnot. And then I have people on the complete opposite spectrum who are like, if they even try to, like, touch my chair or whatnot, like, they get the death stare or, you know, that kind of thing. But for me, it really just, I try to think of it from the other person's perspective. Like, I understand they're trying to help. But I also want to not discredit my independence too. So it's a hard balance, and it really does depend on my mood. you know, I'm not perfect. So depending on the situation, I either brush it off or I, I take the help, but it really just depends. It's a toss up between like wanting people to realize that I'm independent and that I'm capable, and just like letting people help.
So what's the best approach for somebody? I mean, and like, can you give us a lesson? A brief lesson on like you or somebody else. I mean, hopefully our community just grows to become even more inclusive, and we. Mm-hmm. But somebody shows up and I'm a greeter. Mm-hmm. What's the best approach?
I mean, I think it's hard because when you say just like, for me, just ask me like, if I look like I'm visibly struggling, because then there's other times where that answer would not fly with me either. Yeah. I mean, I've had examples of things even in the church community where I don't know if we want to keep this in, but I mean, it's raw and it's real, but within the last couple months or maybe the last month, I had someone come up to me. I was sitting in the back. I wasn't on the tech team that day serving, but we were doing communion. And the song, like, I was just in my feels, and I was just really having a moment with Jesus, and I was crying, I had my eyes closed, and just in tears, and then I feel someone, like, tapping on my leg or something, and it scared the crap out of me, and I'm just like... Oh my God, because it totally like took me out of my like my moment, my zone. And she was like, hey, do you want me to get you the communion? And for me, like, I don't know. I mean, I do. So, and I don't know what I was feeling in that moment, but I was just like, I was super irritated about that. Like, that took me off the rails, and I even had to have. I talked to someone later about it, but I'm just like, in that moment, I was just like thinking to myself, no, like, I'm independent. Like, I drove here, first of all. I can wheel myself over to the communion, or I can just get out of my chair because I have that ability, just get communion. And so I felt very, I don't know, violated. I felt very violated. Mm-hmm. And my independence was just like, not even regarded. And then there's other times where I'm just like, yeah, sure. I need the help because I'm obviously struggling.
Yeah.
But when I'm in my moment with Jesus, like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, but at the same time, I was like, I was trying to think, like, trying to process my emotions of like why I was feeling the way I was. And I'm just like trying to think of that other person's perspective of like, I just, you know, just want to help.
Yeah.
And I was trying to see myself through, you know, their eyes, I guess. But then I was also trying to validate my own feelings of like, I'm upset. Like, I feel violated. Like, I feel like they just totally disregarded me as being incapable of something. And so I was wrestling with that for a while that day.
So in addition to that, I mean, I think that's great that you're I mean, it's awesome that you were processing your own feelings and you made space to imagine what it would be like to be the other person and to have compassion, that maybe they just wanted to do something to serve someone else, you know, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But in addition to what I'm hearing you say is like to, you know, to take a step back and really observe and take a moment and like really consider what might be needed or helpful.
Yeah.
What are some other things that you would want people to know? Like, what do you want people to know in the church community, particularly, or anywhere? I mean, like, what do you, not, it's not limited to the church community. I mean, but what do you want people to know for, and again, you're not speaking on behalf of the whole disabled community because every, it's very nuanced.
Right. Yeah. At least for me, but I do think the whole community would agree, but that we are capable. I am capable. And I think I'm just now, like within the last couple of years, starting to really try to take that back. And in like my belief about myself, it's like me trying to retrain my brain to say, you are capable, and really see what my like what my true identity is, you know, because like God says that I'm capable. God, you know, he created me, like I'm really working on seeing myself in, through his eyes versus, you know, the society's eyes, but I want people to know that I'm capable, and that, yeah, I mean, that's really the biggest thing, is that I'm capable, if, you know.
And maybe get to know you for your capabilities.
I mean,
for you as a person, but to not just assume what you're capable of or not capable of.
Yeah, I mean, assumption is the biggest thing. Like, people just
Know what assuming does. John's nodding. John, you're a very, John's our new producer. He's intern John, and he is a very active producer, and I'm kind of loving it. I'm just going to say, it's really great.
Hi, John.
He's nodding. He's smiling. He's cheering us on. It's great.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. But yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing. Like, I want people in the church and outside of the church to just see us as human beings, foremost, that we deserve to be treated like everyone else. You know, we may like have, we may look different, or we, you know, we might have different abilities, but we are still human beings. Yeah. And I feel like that just needs to be, I don't know, that needs to change.
Yeah, and you're a big girl. You can set your own boundaries, and you can say no, and you can ask for help, and you can, I mean, those are all things everybody has to learn. I mean, I feel like I've had to learn that in my own life. I've had to learn to set boundaries, and I've had to learn how to ask for help, and I've had to be okay being on the receiving end of things, and you know, all those things. So that's
I think I want other people to know too, that like I've had like teaching opportunities to like kind of have conversations with people after you know, they've maybe asked me something and whatnot. I really want to be the person that like takes those opportunities to educate and realize that like we all make mistakes. I've made mistakes, like, so to not be afraid, like not go from like wanting to help, you know, all the time and whatnot, to being afraid to, you know, ask someone for help, or specifically someone with a disability. You know, I want them to feel just the freedom of like, it's okay, you know, to, I mean, just feel it out though. Like, yeah, that's just feel out the situation and just think, ask yourself, I think, what are the reasons why you're asking? Is it, are you asking because you think that I'm not capable? Or is there something like that you're seeing that is like allowing you to want to ask, you know. Mm-hmm. I think people have different motives and they think, oh, I just, you know, I want to help the poor, like, disabled girl, you know. Yeah. I think just checking yourself first before you say anything too.
Is it for you or is it for me?
Right. Like, mm-hmm. I just helped this person, like, go me, you know.
Yeah. So you've talked about your anxiety, mm-hmm. and you've talked about your fear of failure and your fear of rejection.
Mm-hmm.
What are, and you, these are things that you said you've become aware of in the last couple of years more.
Yeah.
And I mean, you seem like you're doing a lot of work on mm-hmm. yourself. So what is God teaching you? How are you growing in those areas? How are you finding ways to cope with your anxiety and whatnot?
I think what I'm really trying to learn is relearning my identity, and that I am capable, it's a loaded question. What am I learning?
Or what are you doing? Are you in therapy, or are you in a group?
I wasn't in therapy, but I decided that it wasn't really working out for me. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really getting out what I needed. But I don't know. God's really teaching me in this season, like, especially since I moved,
mm-hmm.
Basically how to become my own person too. Because of the fact that I've lived in fear, and like anxiety my whole life basically, and not even really realizing it. Now that I'm kind of realizing it, I'm realizing how much I kind of stole from myself, I guess. Wanting to have my, like, I'm not really a very strong opinionated person, but I realized that, like, I just wanted to fit in because I didn't want to be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized that I don't even really have my own, like, preferences of, like, even the simplest things. Like, I mean, I don't have a good example, but I basically would just go with whatever other people liked. So I don't have my own, you know, so I feel like I'm coming into my own identity, I guess, as my own person, because especially moving, like, I don't have the, opinions or whatnot of, like, say my family or whatnot. Mm. Like, I think that's really allowed me to do that work being away from family.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's hard, but it's allowing me to see who God made me to be, though, too, which is, you know, what I needed, you know. That's,
yeah.
So, yeah.
That's beautiful to watch.
Yeah.
It definitely seems like you're finding your voice.
Trying. Yeah, I mean, moving to Nashville really has been a blessing. I didn't realize, I feel like at the time I was just wanting to, one, get away from the weather, and two, I picked Nashville because of the whole event industry, and like live events and stuff like that, wanting to get into the industry somehow. But I realized, like, it was also more about, like, my, you know, becoming who God created me to be. And so this is really has been an opportunity to allow me to do that. So
that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's been really helpful to hear you talk about this. So we appreciate your vulnerability and your willingness to be honest and raw and open up to us. Yep. So if you'd like to get to know Laura, you can find her, again, often sitting by the sound booth or in the sound booth.
Mm-hmm. You never know which
one. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me, Susie.
If you enjoyed today's episode, we would love it if you would share a screenshot of this episode to your Instagram story and tag us at journey_TN. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app.